Kira Sullivan with me today, lead consultant for Esri Ireland. This is going to be a really good talk, but first off, Kira, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks, Jasmine. How are you keeping?
Doing good. Yeah, we were talking about my race that I did this morning, a half marathon, and kind of some fun details about hitting a wall at mile 10, which folks, if you train for a half marathon, at least train up to 12 miles. Don't think 10 is okay. Train up to 12. That's just my little tidbit. Other than that, yeah, I'm doing great. So, Kira, tell us a little bit about yourself, some fun details, your background, where you come from, your education, things like that.
Sure. So, as you can probably tell by the accent, I'm from Ireland. I was born in England, actually, to Irish parents, but moved over to Ireland when I was 7 and to the southwest of Ireland in a nice small town. And I had my introduction to the Irish language at that stage. So I went from being a little English schoolgirl to coming into school in County Kerry in Ireland and starting to learn Irish for the first time. So that was a bit of a whirlwind. And that turned into me going to an all-Irish secondary school. So kind of like a high school for a couple of years. So I did all of my subjects through the Irish language, including like science and history and maths and things like that. Probably couldn't speak more than a couple of lines of it now. So it just goes to show if you don't use it, you lose it. But I suppose as a teenager, I was kind of really into more like the arts, like music and painting and things like that. But I also had a love of science in school at that age. So I was really into biology at that age. I found it one of my easier subjects, I suppose, in high school. And then fast forward a bunch of years later, I had a few different interests that I maybe pursued and then stopped and found my way eventually. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I went back to college, and that's when I started the degree of field biology with wildlife tourism. So it's a bit of a mouthful, but overall it was a ecology-based course, really. And that's where I actually had my first introduction to GIS. I didn't know what GIS was in the world until I started my undergrad. Fast forward another 4 years later, I then completed my degree with B, 28 years old. I finally have my degree. Great. Went out into the world. And I suppose I started my professional career from that stage. Yeah, along the way, I've developed a few habits that kind of satisfies my inner hippie. I'm a big animal lover. I turned vegetarian when I was 25. I started hiking quite a lot. I like to do a little bit of species ID in my spare time. I wouldn't say I'm an expert at it by any means, but it gets me out and about outdoors, which I'm definitely at my happiest when I'm outdoors, out in nature. So that's about it.
When you say species ID, can you go a little bit more into that? I feel like I already know that. I mean, I feel like the title kind of is self-explanatory, but if you want to go a little bit more into detail, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it is fun, actually. It's it can be challenging. So it's really good to take it in small, like really small kind of bites. So species ID as a subject is really broad, but effectively what it means is that you're able to identify a living thing. So it could be anything from a ladybird to a flower that's out in your front lawn, or it could be a bird or a seashell. It's really any sort of living being that you can identify to a species level. So in biology, you have different levels of taxonomy, and identifying a living thing to species level is kind of, the difference between us and the apes, for example. We're different species, difference between dogs and hyenas, things like that. But when you get down to a species level, especially with flowers, it can get really, really, really layered. So the deeper you go into it, the more you learn. And it's a nice way to kind of look at the world in a bit of a different, slower pace. I suppose with species ID, what I found first fascinating about the topic when I first started my experience with it when I was in college was, before I started looking at things at a species level, I would go out to a front lawn and just see grass. Whereas when you start to look at things at a species level, you start to see that that grass is actually made up of 10 different species. So you have your clover and you have your, you know, just at a different species level, you realize how layered things are and how much diversity there is amongst things. So it's just really, it can be fun, quite nerdy maybe, but.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Kind of like a Pokemon Go, but for the natural planet, you know.
Oh man, I remember that game, seeing everyone walk into traffic or run into poles. And I didn't get into it just because I wasn't dedicated enough. I like Pokemon, but I just never was dedicated enough because I was just lazy. But it was fun watching the people because you knew who they were because they were just like in groups and just mindlessly walking around. And then you knew that they were like playing Pokemon Go. Those were good times. So you said that you didn't know about GIS until you actually got into your biology degree. So what kind of drove you to go towards GIS?
One of the factors actually was that the GIS element of our course was probably one of the easiest parts for me. And I know that it wasn't that way for everybody. But for me, I did find that aspect just really interesting. I really liked interacting with the software for making our habitat maps, doing analysis, and I just took a shining to it at that point. I just really enjoyed it. And it wasn't something that I had thought about even during my undergrad that I would be pursuing when I finished my degree. At that point, it was just oh, this is a cool piece of kit. I didn't know at that stage that there was actually careers in GIS available. I wasn't at that stage even exposed to that. So I always thought it was something that I would end up having to use as well as doing fieldwork. But it was actually only until my final year that I discovered that there was graduate placements available in the Central Statistics Office in Ireland. So I applied to that. And the role there was for a GIS graduate. So I applied for that. And then I enjoyed my year there so much. I continued. I just ran with it after that. It just was a good fit.
How did all of that, well, I guess I should say, how was finding, how did you lead up into a lead consultant?
So when I finished with the graduate placement at the Central Statistics Office, I actually applied for a role with Esri Ireland, but as a contractor. And luckily for me, they actually interviewed me for a consultant role at that stage. So they took my application. They said, no, you don't want that role. You want this role. So I interviewed for it anyway. And then I started there in 2019 as a consultant. So from that stage then, I suppose since that time, I've worked with a variety of different customers in different sectors. A lot of, say, the experience that I would have had initially on some of the first projects I was working on was around the Inspire directive that probably doesn't make any sense actually in the US because it's an EU directive around data interoperability. And so Inspire is notoriously difficult for people to deal with. So I kind of felt like I had a birth of fire in that first kind of project that I was working on. But essentially the takeaway for Inspire is data projections and also metadata. So making sure that these things are quite consistent across different countries within the EU. And yeah, I suppose I had a lot of infrastructure kind of build up learning in that space as well, because we have a lot of clients that would do a cloud-based infrastructure now. I think a lot of people are moving away from the days where they would have their server room in the building. A lot of people are moving to the cloud now. And it was that on-the-ground experience then. I moved into a senior consultant position. And really the only main difference in my role at that point was I was maybe not having to take as much direction from the lead consultant at that time. I was kind of being given a little bit more remit to kind of lead with the technical tasks that were expected of me. So I suppose the main thing that comes up quite a lot when we're working on projects is we always have a plan that we follow, but things come up all the time. Requirements can change. Security requirements can change. The web is a very dynamic space and different requirements come up all the time. Really, it was kind of making sure that I was getting to the right level where I was getting comfortable with, you know, the adaptations that come with that. And then from that point on, then I joined the development program, which was an internal program that we had in the company. And I went through kind of 8 months of on-the-job training to get to the lead consultant role. It's been great. It's very challenging, but it's interesting. You know, as I say, the goalposts are always moving. So, you know, it kind of keeps you on your toes. And the nice thing about being in a lead consultant position is you're, instead of coming in maybe at a little bit, kind of, it's just instead of coming in at, say, the implementation phase of a project, you're a lot more involved with the initial planning and maybe a lot of the conversations that you get to have with clients and customers around their requirements and really getting to know about what they need from, you know, from the solution at the end of the day. So that's been a really nice side of it as well, to kind of be able to be involved from the very beginning and not have to, you know, hear that information secondhand, maybe, that you're in those initial discussions at the beginning. So, I'd say I've been quite surprised at getting to this stage, you know, say 4 years in, but also really well supported. In work, we have a coachee program as well. And I've just been really fortunate with the projects that I've been working on all along, that I've been involved in really great teams. So I've been able to develop quite quickly through the different roles to get to this point. So yeah, it's a constant learning environment, put it that way. I'm sure you can probably relate.
Yeah, I mean, 4 years. I mean, first off, congratulations. You know, that probably just shows how well you are doing at your job. And then, yes, I completely agree. Because my current role, I am learning 24/7. And so there's always a training. And I'm like, oh, my God, I just want to get to the point to where I don't have to, I can just turn my brain off and I have to keep learning something. And I don't know when that'll end, actually, because of where we are right now on certain projects that we have. But I'm like, I'm always learning something. But one day it'll come to where I can come into work, I already know what I'm doing, and I can just shut off. But that's not probably not going to happen for a few months. So what skills do you think that you've had that kind of led you within 4 years to get to lead consultant?
Yeah, I think you need to have good communication skills, first off, because you need to, first of all, be able to interpret what someone's needs are from a solution and make sure that you're delivering it to the spec that they're expecting. And as a consultant, when I first joined with Esri Ireland, the skills I already had at that point was probably good attention to detail, the ability to adapt in a situation, and the ability to communicate well verbally with my colleagues, say. But what the skills that I've had to learn or maybe develop on since that point is, I would say, being able to deal with, say, just being able to deal with a higher workload, you know, the stresses that come with more responsibility, I suppose. You also have to be good at troubleshooting, because you'll always have a plan, but, you know, things will always, curveballs will always come up. There might always be something that you weren't, you know, possibly expecting, or something has to change the course due to a limitation in, say, the client's infrastructure, or due to a limitation with the data or something like that. Just being able to think on your toes. But really, I think it all comes down to being able to prioritize as well. The technical skill that you need, of course, is there. But I feel like that's very much nearly the same amongst all of our colleagues, really, at Esri Ireland. I feel like the difference is when you start to take on more responsibility as you grow up, maybe through the roles, because you're actually less hands-on and it becomes more about the bigger picture. It's really just being able to hone in on what's really important and what are the non-negotiables what do you need to really deliver at the end of this? Because I think what we can maybe be guilty of sometimes when we're working on a project, especially if it's a passion project and it's something we really love, is you could spend all day at it and you could throw all the resources at it in the world. But really, with the environment that we work in, people have a limited budget. They don't have all the resources in the world to throw at, you know, different deployments, or sometimes you're under a real time pressure. Like, for example, when COVID was rampant, I don't mean to bring it all back or anything, but when COVID was rampant, we were working on a data hub and those releases had to go out 2-3 times a day. Decisions had to be made quickly. You know, we couldn't make everything visually perfect, or we didn't have time to kind of think about some of those things sometimes. Like, the really important thing was that people got the information. It's being able to make those decisions like that, I think, and maybe understanding that you're not necessarily going to get all the wins all the time, but what are the non-negotiables and what can you live with and what can't you live with, you know, or what can you live without? The other thing I think you need as well as a lead consultant is a bit of an understanding for maybe potentially new consultants coming into the business, being aware that everyone comes from different backgrounds, everyone's experience is different. For example, I have a biology background. A lot of my colleagues would be very much developer backgrounds. So I think it's really just important not to make assumptions at where people are at, that you kind of establish that we're on the same page or we're not. And if we're not, what do we need to do to get to the same page before we progress, you know? So that you're not leaving people behind, or that you're not potentially misinterpreting what someone is saying, because they might think that what you're saying has a different meaning. So I think just establishing that baseline of understanding as well is really, really important, because otherwise you can both be saying, yeah, I get you. Yeah, I understand. That's great. But actually, you could be going two completely different directions in your own head. And then that goes both in both ways. I was kind of saying really about consultants at the beginning there, but I think that goes for all sorts of relationships, or, you know, tangents within the business and with clients as well. It's really important to make sure that it's a very clear understanding in everyone's part.
Sometimes I think some people can think that they are talking in a way that makes sense for them, which is fine, but then depending on, sometimes I like to think of it as everyone's brains work differently. And so like the way you're communicating to me, I process that maybe differently compared to how you're actually saying it. I definitely deal with that at my job as well. And I think that's how you thrive, even as a team, that if you can understand or be somewhat of a chameleon of how your team, how your teammates work, because everyone's not going to think the same way.
Absolutely. And wouldn't it be boring if we all did?
Yeah. And actually, I was like, I could go off on a tangent, because previous jobs, they all thought everyone thought the same way. But I was like, but we could be here for an hour on that. But I was like, now I'm going to start venting.
I just want to piggyback one bit off you said there, because, you know, the way you said, like, you're totally right. Everyone's brains work differently and we all have different strengths. That's one thing we actually did in work was, I don't know if you've heard about StrengthsFinder. It's kind of like a quiz that you can do, basically, right? And it's, you answer like these multiple choice questions. So as a company, we all did this StrengthsFinder. And what's really cool about the result is you don't just get, you get like a summary of your 5 top strengths. But what you also get is like, these are the StrengthsFinder types that you'd work really well with, because they have these qualities that, you know, you might not be so great at. So you're a really good team with these kind of, you know, people that have these strengths. Also said that you might have difficulty understanding some people who have these strengths, you know. So it was just really, really interesting. And I just thought it was a really nice quiz to do, because it really does take into account that we are all different. We all have different strengths. I had to laugh at my result, though, because it was like communication, empathy, like a lot of, like, I was like, wow, mine just says I have a lot of feelings. Like, responsibility, communication, empathy. It was like a lot of like really like people focused kind of, you know, strengths, whereas some other people got some really like organizational ones, like, and stuff. I just thought it was really interesting.
Well, I think empathy is really important, like, as a leader, because I guess this is just my opinion from people who have experience who do not have that. I think empathy is very important when you have a team of just different individuals that you're working with. I found that to be some of my best leaders or my best manager, supervisor. I wouldn't say boss, just because I think boss has a negative connotation unless you are a boss.
Yeah.
In a negative way. But to me, I think a leader definitely has a more empathetic side. But yeah, that's very good. Now that we've kind of talked about your consulting side, unless you had some more that you wanted to give off before we branch into your biology side.
Yeah, like, I mean, the consulting side, all I would say is that if you're a person who really loves to do GIS on desktop every day, like you're really into like going into pro and making maps, consultancy is maybe not for you, because as a consultant, your job is to guide other people along on their GIS journey, you know, so that might be a whole new GIS deployment. It might be honing in on a specific, you know, kind of data modeling, or it might be honing in on a specific delivery of an app or, you know, a kind of web GIS that they need to deliver, either because it's a government mandate or because they're an NGO that's just got good data and they want to share it with the public. But yeah, if you're really into being the on the ground person, doing the analysis, making the maps yourself, consultancy is probably not for you, because it's a quite hands-off approach, why should I say. You know, you're the enabler. You're the person guiding them through making the right decisions. And, you know, you're the point of contact for, you know, someone who's going through maybe a reorganization, or maybe they're going through a data migration or something like this. And you're the person that they come to, you know, for what should I do in this scenario? What should I do in that scenario? You know, so you're just helping them go along with meeting their GIS needs. But it's very satisfying when you get to do that and do it well with people, and you see the efficiency of their systems completely change. So it's definitely an interesting career. But I feel like in consultancy, that's why the goalposts move so much, because you're actually not a specialist at all. You're a complete generalist, you know. So the more things that keep getting added in, the more, you know, you kind of have to take on and learn and adapt all the time. And something that was really popular 4 years ago might not be used at all anymore now. So it's just interesting in that way. But yeah, that's it about consultancy, I think.
Very cool. Well, now we're going to shift from the consulting. So before we go into Ireland's biodiversity and also some of the climate change that is happening within Ireland itself, do you want to give us a little bit of background on what is currently going on with that?
Sure, like in a global sense or in an Irish context?
Irish context.
Okay, that's good to know, because a global context, I don't know if I'd be qualified to answer that question. And I'm not necessarily saying I'm qualified to answer the Irish context question, right? But this is just my opinion. But yeah, it's definitely a topic. Biodiversity, but also maybe climate change in general, has become a much more well-known topic in Ireland in recent years. So when I was in college, which really isn't that long ago, I graduated in 2018. But when I was in college, I would have been explaining to a lot of people what it is, what biodiversity was, what it meant. A lot of people didn't know what it meant. Whereas I feel like that it's getting a lot more kind of TV time now. It's getting a lot more airtime. People are more aware of what it is, but I still don't think that in a general sense, we talk about it in a detailed enough context for people to really understand the depth of it.
When I looked it up, that there are people trying to take action, but it seems like a lot of the plans that have gone through with Ireland to solve some of the issues, environmental issues that are going on, it seems like there is some form of inaction. Why does this have a personal, I guess you could say, place in your heart?
I suppose. Well, for me, I always went back to this time. So before I started college, before I went back to do that biology course, before I went back to do field biology with wildlife tourism, I was in a job that I hated at the time. I really didn't enjoy getting up to go to work every day. And then I thought to myself, okay, what could I do? What could I do that's completely different and what would be really good for me? And I just thought back to this time that when I was in school, took this trip, not that far from where I live now. And we took this trip that involved us hiking a mountain. Well, it's probably a hill, really, in US standards, but hiking a hill, coming down the other side, camping in a forest overnight, and then canoeing across the lakes of Killarney. It has a huge popularity, like nationwide in Ireland, but also globally. We get a lot of tourists that come to Killarney every year. And the Lakes of Killarney is also a special area of conservation. So it's also a national park in Ireland. It has an awful lot of natural heritage. And some of our extremely tiny pockets of ancient oak woodland are located in Killarney. When I was 16, going up that mountain and going into the woods and kayaking, I didn't have a knowledge of that, but I have such a fond memory of that time and that experience. And when I was in the depths of my despair, when I was in my early 20s and I was going, what am I going to do with my life? Having a, you know, a moment of crisis. I thought back to that time and how inherently happy that it made me. And I decided I just need to do something that's with the outdoors. I need to find a way that I can get into the outdoors. So it was actually the wildlife tourism part of my course title that got me intrigued into getting into that. And it was only then when I got into the course that the first year we had environmental science and we had biology and we had biodiversity come up a lot then. So that was really me learning what biodiversity meant in a scientific context. And because as well, the college that I went to was based in Kerry, I was able to return to these places that I visited as a youngster, return to these places that I would know locally. I had lived away in a city not far from Kerry for about 5 or 6 years before I got to this point. So I was returning to all these like really safe places for me as a child and actually putting a scientific context on them and an environmental science perspective. And it just blew my mind. It just really opened up my eyes to the wonder of the complexity and the special nature of what I had on my doorstep, you know, which I didn't really realize. I could feel it. I had the inherent feeling of it and the appreciation of it, but I didn't have the knowledge behind it. So I think that's why during all the field trips that I had during college, but then also afterwards, it's had a huge place in my heart because I can see it. I know exactly. I can point out the spots in the park where this is an invasive species. This is, you know, causing harm in our local park. These are the species that we need to protect. This is ancient oak. This is really important. And this is why it's important. You know, so it's really tangible for me. And I think that's the really important part about conserving anything is people have to love it and they have to know what it is. If they don't know what they're supposed to be protecting, it's never going to work. So I feel like that's why sometimes when the word biodiversity kind of gets thrown around in big plans and big roadmaps that the government produces, it can be with great intentions. But the reason why we fail to bring it to fruition sometimes is because there's not actually a huge mass of people that have the ability to identify what that actually means. And yeah, it's nobody's fault. It's just, I suppose, I think for people working in that area for a very long time, it must be very frustrating and it must be unusual now for it to start getting so much attention and so much media attention. And yeah, hopefully it's not too late that it's getting all this attention. But one big thing that I have noticed in Ireland, even since I graduated, like when I was in college, the jobs that would be available, say, in the kind of ecology space were very, very limited. Whereas now it's very, very easy to find a job advert for an ecologist in Ireland today. And there's also a huge recruitment going on with the NPWS, which is our National Parks and Wildlife Service. So the traction is definitely picking up. I feel like we're starting to realize that we need experts on the ground. We need people, you know, doing the surveys, doing the recording. Like the biggest tool, you know, that ecologists use for biodiversity is monitoring. You know, they have to see what's there. They have to see what the impact of this action is. There is a organization in Ireland called the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and they actually take records from the public as part of recording biodiversity in Ireland. So, you know, you or I or anyone in their own town or, you know, their own locality can download their app and start identifying species. So if you only know what a crow looks like, that's fine. You can record the crow in your front garden and you can submit that record. Where they see gaps in the data, like if there's a lot of, say there's a lot of kind of really interesting flora species in the Burren in Ireland, which is a really cool karst landscape. And there's a lot of really interesting, you know, botanical finds there that you might need more experts involved in, you know, kind of surveying. So they will fill in the gaps with the experts, but really as a tool to bring in that level of data every year consistently, it's, you know, it's a huge power source. And it's only having a knowledge base like that that will inform government decisions correctly, you know, or that will back up the decisions when people say you can't do that because that's going to have a really bad negative impact on the environment. You can say, here is the data, you know, this was done in this area before and now we don't have this, you know, the curlew species has gone from this area now. And this is why we can see a direct correlation. To have that data available is powerful. It's really about making sure that we have the resources, so we have the experts available, we have the people on the ground doing the work, but that we're also able to use that information that they're collecting then to inform decisions. So I feel like it's starting to maybe, you know, look like we're starting to head that way. However, I will say a lot of the ecologist positions that come up, and I only know about all this because I'm still in contact with a lot of my peers from college. So a lot of them work in that field. And the feedback really is that there's a lot of private consultancy companies, you know, that would work in development, for example, and they want an ecologist on board because it's part of their requirements that they need to do environmental impact assessments. However, it's not in their interest really to protect the environment. They're ticking a box. They're making sure that they're kind of going by the laws there. So making sure that we have an equally large pool of resources in our government organizations that are there to protect our, you know, that's their sole job, to protect the environment. Like there needs to be an equal investment in that, because when you have a conflict of interests, you know, it's I'm not accusing anybody of trying to destroy the environment, you know, but really if your prerogative is to make sure that you're building X amount of houses this year, which is also an important topic in Ireland right now, that your main number one interest is not going to be, oh, I really hope we don't disturb that habitat that is going to be next door to the housing estate that we're building. Do you know what I mean? So there needs to be enough funding going into the bodies that are working on actually protecting the environment, you know. And then I think even at that stage, we still have a long way to go in a European context. We're way behind, way, way behind. And it's actually, from a biodiversity standpoint, but also from an emission standpoint, our stats are just going up and up and up. And they need to be coming down, you know. So we're talking the talk up here, but we're not walking the walk at the moment. And that's where the issue lies, you know.
I'm right there with you that I really wish that this just wasn't something you had to pay people to do, or this was just something that was just common knowledge. Like, okay, we're all living on this earth. How can we do things that are not going to damage it down the line? Everything that's happening with climate change is human influenced. It's kind of a sad thing that there has to be some type of incentivization to help the earth. Many times I've been on road trips and I've seen someone just throw like a bottle out their car, and or someone just throws a bottle, you know, you know, just steps away from a trash can. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just,
that drives me nuts. That one, when it's like, they drop it like 5 feet away from the trash can. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's right there.
Yeah. It's sad. So
I think though, Jasmine, it's due to a disconnect, like looking after or working with the earth. Cause we are part of biodiversity at the end of the day. You know, we are part of it. We're natural, like, you know, earth beings, like we are part of it. And it's just the society that we live in and the physical built landscape that we live in has us really disconnected from what used to come naturally to us. So I know it's a bit heartbreaking, but it's also, I think what would be ideal is that our entire system of how we live would change, but we definitely can't do that overnight. So we have to try and make small changes within our bounds now. But yeah, I think ultimately, wouldn't it be nice to just throw the whole template away and just start again and just say, here, look, this is how we're going to build our societies and we need more community involvement here and we need to kind of restructure what we value and how we interact with each other. But, you know, I'm living in a house that has central heating and, you know, I'm very much part of the, like, say, the modern, you know, westernized world as our other millions of people. We have to try and meet people where they're at with a little bit of compassion that we can't necessarily change everything overnight, but here's, let's focus on what we can do, you know?
Definitely. So you already kind of talked about the website, Biodiversity Data. What was the full website name?
Oh, the Biodiversity Data Center.
Data Center. Okay, I was just missing one word. Okay. So the Biodiversity Data Center, which I actually did check out, which is a pretty cool website. But how do you think GIS would be able to help some of these issues?
Yeah, I think it's got a lot of scope in this area because the scope of what we need to assess and what we need to kind of address to tackle climate change and to tackle biodiversity loss is actually huge. It's actually in every part of our world and of our lives at the moment. Like transport is a big one. There's changes that need to be made, but there's also the element of responding to current emergencies. And GIS kind of ticks all the boxes in all those situations. Yeah, it's funny, and I don't want to sound cringy or anything, but I think it could literally be applied to every single problem that we have when it comes to what we need to assess and what we need to change. Like one or two examples, maybe, I suppose. There have been an issue with fires in, you know, so it's quite common practice for agricultural purposes that prescribed fires would be lit to burn what they call the gorse bushes. And it's kind of a bit of a land management practice, and there's very specific conditions. And a lot of the time, those factors are ignored. So what can happen then is that the vegetation is too dry. It's outside of the period. So there's breeding season potentially going on with different birds and that, or, you know, all different animals. And this has led to outbreaks of fires in my beloved Killarney National Park, but other areas in Ireland as well. And it's definitely not at the scale. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to say this and not acknowledge the length and the breadth of the wildfires that have been happening in both the States and in South America and in Australia and all over the world. You know, that is absolutely devastating impact and heartbreaking to see. And this is on a much smaller scale. But I do think that GIS has, you know, a huge advantage of, you know, using the LIDAR kind of data, bringing in aerial imagery, assessing the impact of things like that at such a huge scale and being able to do it without having too many people on the ground, because what can potentially sometimes be a dangerous situation as well. So I think GIS comes into every aspect. We need to think about the kind of the monitoring of erosion, the monitoring of wildfires, like different things like this. GIS is already definitely a huge part in that. But even just identifying pockets where we are without public infrastructure in Ireland, it's also a massive problem in Ireland that if you live outside Dublin, which is the capital city, access to public transport is really quite poor. Yet one of the huge policies that the government kind of want to bring in is to encourage people to stop using their cars and to take public transport. But in reality, that's really not an option where I live for a lot of people. Like if they have a 9-to-5 job, for example, and they need to go to the next town over, in a lot of places, it's just not an option to get public transport. So I think even doing analysis on what public infrastructure we have in Ireland in that area would be a really good one to just back up some of the figures that they are trying to maybe idealise in a way. But in reality, like, people in the countryside are really frustrated with that kind of information because they just feel like they don't have another option. And buying an electric car for most people is completely unaffordable. So it's just not an option. But I also think GIS is, again, I think a lot of these systems already exist. Like, there's a flood maps application that is used quite often in Ireland. There's definitely coastal erosion surveys that happen quite often. We have the biodiversity database. But yeah, I think funny enough, actually, there was a really cool one recently as well that it's Inland Fisheries Ireland. So they recently launched a hub for data collection as well with anglers. So what type of fish are they catching? Overfishing as well is a huge issue globally. Seeing government bodies or NGOs coming in like that as well, actively interested in seeking out this information from people is really good. But ultimately, GIS is a tool. It can only do so much. It's not going to fix it for us. You know, we need to make sure that we're using it in the right way, we're using it for the right reasons, and that I think it can be a massive tool with the help of helping the climate crisis, but we need to have an invested interest in actually achieving it as well, and rather than just doing it as a tick box exercise or doing it because we think that's what the public wants, or there needs to be actual action behind it, because GIS can give you a lot of answers, but you still need to make that action on the basis of those answers. It's not actually going to fix the problem, but it's definitely going to give people tools to make, again, informed decisions and be able to present the evidence when they say this is what's actually going on the ground, you know?
Definitely. First of all, I have to say, Kira, talking to you is awesome and it's amazing. And I feel like we have like a really good flow. Before we go ahead and send off, were there any lasting thoughts that you want to give?
No, really, Jasmine, all I want to say is thank you so much for inviting me on. It's been something I haven't done before. I've never, you know, been involved in a podcast, but to see someone who's took the initiative to start up a GIS focused podcast was really, really cool. So thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kira, for coming on the show. Again, guys, this is GIS Chat Podcast. And we will see you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Thanks, Jasmine.